Well, we come this evening to what I think is one of the more beautiful of the Psalms. Certainly there are many beautiful ones. But this one is so practical, I think, as far as living a godly life. Psalm 101, Rafe read for us a few moments ago. We'll title it, The Resolve of a Righteous Heart. The resolve that David has to live righteously and the steps that he's going to take to make that come about. The type of people that he's going to surround himself with, the type of people that he's going to put at a distance from him, the type of things that he's going to bring before his eyes, and so forth, and the all geared toward being a godly, righteous person. This one, you know, we're kind of looking at royal/messianic. This psalm is not really messianic. It's more just a royal psalm. Focuses on righteousness, justice, piety, just living a good, godly, righteous life. Some of the things that come out in it kind of remind us of some of the admonitions that we see in the Proverbs, that the different steps that he's going to do, and some of the advice that's given in the Proverbs certainly go hand in hand. There's kind of two parts to the appeal to God that we have here in the psalm. The first several verses, the first five verses for the most part, deal with David himself, with David's life, the king's life, and characterized by the phrase "my heart." And then he kind of comes back at the end of the psalm, verses 6-8, and is looking at some of the same things, but more from the view of his court, as he is the king. And again, how is he going to deal with people as people come to him to be judged and so forth? And how is he going to do that in a godly way? And there you see the phrase, my house. And so my heart, dealing more with David himself, and my house, David dealing with his judgments, his ruling. You know, David's in a unique position. He not only has his own personal life to worry about, as we all do, but he also had that added responsibility of being the king, the ruler over God's nation, God's people, Israel. And so that was a responsibility that David seemed to take very seriously. But he wants to order his life according to the ideas of righteous living. A man after God's own heart. Certainly comes out very, very strongly in this psalm. And so he's motivated by the desire to walk blamelessly, perfect, before his God. And so he vows to remove all of those things that are base and vile away from his mind. He refuses to have fellowship with evil people, with wrongdoers. He dedicates himself to walking honestly and nobly before his God. And so we have a personal resolution that this godly leader of God's people wants to live a godly life himself, and he wants to rule the nation of Israel in a proper and godly way. You know, there's not much more that you could ask than that. There's not much more of a leader. You know, as we went through the recent election and some of our prayers that we've had here, you know, for godly men that would lead in a godly way and go back to godly principles. And I guess we kind of see the epitome of that in David and the heart that he had and the desire that he had as a leader to lead in that proper and godly way. Each thought that we see in the psalm is filled with David's personal determination to be like God, to be godly, to have those godly characteristics in himself. Every line of the psalm, except for the very last one, contain a first-person reference. David used the word I 10 times, me 6 times, my 5 times. And sometimes when we see that, we think, well, here's a guy who's proud and puffed up, and it's all about me, but that's not the case here. It's David's desire, expressing his desire for him as a person to live in accordance with God's will and God's ways. And so we have a portrait, we might say, of a servant ruler. And maybe it is a little messianic in that sense, and certainly we have a servant ruler in our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Well, as we begin to look at the psalm itself, first of all, we see, I will sing. Maybe. So the first topic is brings out the attributes of mercy and justice, long-suffering. David sees those attributes in Yahweh, in Jehovah God. And he wants to emulate those properties within himself as a ruler and as a king. He says, I will sing of mercy and justice. So as he reaches up to these traits of God's holy character, he sets his heart to pursue that path, to bring those attributes into himself, to pursue that perfect way, as he says there in verse 2. And again, that meaning more the blameless way. Blameless is the way that the New American Standard translates it. But mercy, the covenant love or grace of God, and justice, the fair-mindedness and impartiality of God's judgments. And of course, we see throughout Scripture how those two attributes oftentimes work together and kind of balance one another toward that perfection. That mercy keeps justice from becoming too rigid, and justice keeps mercy from becoming too relaxed, and the two just work together in that perfection, certainly within the Godhead. They're necessary elements and characters of a righteous God. They're also necessary elements of a righteous king. And so David is striving for those attributes. In addition, he says, to you, O Lord, I will sing praises. He's offering the sweet-sounding music of his heart and of his voice to God, and the word that's used, that's what it means. The sweet-sounding music of the heart and the voice. He can't see his life as being properly lived unless he's regularly participating in praising God. It's a regular part of what he does and of who he is. The giving of adoration and homage to his God are a very important part of his life, day in and day out, not just one day a week or whatever when he might come together to worship. God will not come into David's life or into the life of the city of Jerusalem, of Zion, where the tent is, or the nation of Israel, unless the characteristics of his divine nature are embraced by David and by the people of Israel. He's not going to come in to us unless we embrace those same characteristics of God. A servant is obligated to be like his master, to strive to take on those characteristics. And so he announces, I will behave wisely in a perfect way, verse 2. Again, the New American Standard translates that a blameless way. The word perfect there carries the connotation, again, not the way that we oftentimes think of perfect, because that would eliminate all human beings, but the connotation of beyond reproach. again, blameless in the same way that it's used in the qualification for elders, being perfect, blameless, beyond reproach, meaning that no legitimate accusation can be brought against the person who possesses this particular character trait. And that's the way that David wants to be. He decides to behave wisely about this perfect way of the Lord, to walk in the wisdom of the Lord. And so he sets out to discern it, to seek it, to love it, to live it in his life, to bring it into who he is. Again, a little bit of a discrepancy as far as what the word modifies from translation to translation. The New King James that we use, I will behave wisely in a perfect way. The word perfect there is modifying David's behavior, that his behavior is going to be perfect or blameless or beyond reproach. The New American Standard says, I will give heed to the blameless way. And so the way it's worded there, the word is used to modify the way. But again, that's not going to take us to either one of those paths you go down. It's not really going to take us to a different outcome in the long run. But David's mind is, you know, he wants to be blameless. He wants to walk in that blameless, perfect way. And so probably both are maybe in the minds of David as he's thinking about these things. But having experienced God's covenant love, His righteous judgment, David determines that he must continue to grow in these traits and to be able to convey them to the people that he leads. His leadership of this people is always something that seems to be very important to David, that he is leading them in the proper way. And of course, as we study the Old Testament especially, we can pretty much see as the leaders go, the people go. You know, when they have good leaders, they do pretty good. When they have bad leaders, they do pretty bad. And so David is certainly right in his desire to be godly and to lead them in the proper way, and then they will follow in that way. He asked the question then there in verse 2, "Oh, when will you come to me?" Some have suggested once again that the context, at least of that question, may be the same as what we looked at last week when we looked at Psalm 24, the bringing back of the Ark of the Covenant back into its proper place in Jerusalem. Again, we don't know that for sure, but regardless of what the circumstances may have been, it's evident that David believes that his relationship with God and the city and the nation can only flourish with his making God's character his own, with God coming to him and being a part of him. And he knows that God is not going to come into his life or into the life of the city or into the life of the nation unless he is invited to do so, and that he's only invited to do so by the righteous living of the king and his people as they strive to live in a godly way that is inviting men for God to come and to be a part of them and what they are. Well, so the whole idea then of godliness, being like God, taking on those attributes of God, the life of God's king, of David, in this case, is marked by attributes like covenant love that we see with God, with justice that we see with God. We see praise for God. We see the pursuit of this perfect way, this blameless way that he's striving to walk in. The life that David is trying to live, it's not an abstraction. It's not just a pie in the sky type idea that can never really be attained. But it's a genuine, reachable life. It's a life that we can live. If we truly strive to live a godly life, we can do that. Not to perfection, no. But But we can bring in these godly attributes. And that's what David is eager to do. Eager to seek after those and bring them into himself. And so, moving on to the last part of verse 2 on through verse 5, I will walk with a perfect heart. Now, he's already mentioned that desire to walk that way. The claims of godly living, of course, are empty unless they're demonstrated by the life that we live. Unless we're truly living that type of life, just talking about it does no good. And so it's demonstrated within the heart, within the individual. It's also demonstrated within those closest to us, maybe the family and others that are very close, and then kind of goes out from there. The more general resolves of David's prayers then are narrowed into some specifics now. He doesn't just have this broad, I'm going to live a righteous, godly life. Now, what steps am I going to take? What step A and step B and step C that are going to get me to that point that I want to be in? He says, I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. Again, he has this desire to have that perfect heart. And so he's putting this into the form of an objective of something now that he can do. And how am I going to do that? And so he begins to plan now the implementation, the action, the continuation of what he's going to do to get there. Going beyond the talk to the application. His reference is again to my house, my heart, about his court, his national life, his personal life, and those two, of course, working very closely together. Beyond the righteousness that the public sees in its righteous leader, it is the godliness of his heart that's most visible to those that are closer to him. You know, you can, the further away from a person you get, the easier people are to fool, maybe. But it's very difficult to fool those very closest to you. That's where this godliness is going to be seen the most, with these the inner circle, we might say, beginning with self, family, his cabinet, we might say, his advisors and so forth within his courts, and then spreading on out from that. So David decides, I'm going to disassociate myself from evil. The first thing he sees evidently that he needs to do to achieve this godliness, this perfect way that he wants to walk in, I've got to get rid of some things. I've got to disassociate with evil. And so godliness has both positive and negative components. There are things that we're going to need to embrace to have godliness, and there's some things we're going to have to push away if we're going to have godliness. We seek virtue and we shun evil. And so he says, I will set nothing wicked before my eyes. He's going to remove the wicked, or the worthless, I think the New American Standard says, from his eyes, from his mind. He's not going to pursue those things as a goal. He won't imitate them, but he's going to push them away. The word there is actually uses two words, the word for not or without, and the word for worth. So not worth or without worth. Worthless, wicked. Those things that have no value, I'm not going to set those before my eyes. It's often, the word's often used to people who are dominated by evil to the point that they're without any value. You know, have you ever heard somebody say, you know, so-and-so says, there's no redeeming value left in, well, that's a hard judgment for us to make sometime, but, you know, we, as a person goes further down that road of evil, there's less and less redeeming value there, isn't there? And that's kind of what it's talking about here, this wicked, this worthless. I'm not going to set that before my eyes. And so David vows that he will not allow any evil ambition or those who have permitted evil to capture their hearts, he's not going to allow them to remain in his association. He's not going to have them in front of him. Now, he didn't have some of the things like we have today with television, bringing those things into our living room, and the internet, bringing them into our living room or bedroom or offices or wherever it might be. Same principle would certainly apply. That I'm not going to allow anything on that TV or on that internet that is wicked before my eyes. I'm not going to look upon those things that are going to take me away from that walking in that perfect way. I'm just not going to have anything to do with that. I won't set those in front of me. And then he continues on, I hate the work of those who fall away. He's also not going to dwell in the presence of those who have fallen away from God. Maybe people that were godly at one time in their life, but they've turned their back on God. And so David detests, he hates that lifestyle of those who have departed from God's fellowship. And so he's going to remove himself from those who would lead him and influence him to become untrue to God. None of us need that influence in our life, do we? Somebody that's going to influence us to lose our faith, we don't need that influence. There's no reason to associate with such a person. And so David says he's going to reject them. He's going to reject their example. He bars them from having influence on his life. You know, the people that are around about us have influence on us, whether we acknowledge that or like to accept that or not. They do. Some people for good, some people for bad, some people maybe a mixture of the two. And so we need to be careful about who we associate ourselves with. He goes on in there at the end of verse 3 and says, "It shall not cling to me." I hate the work of those who fall away. It shall not cling to me. The word cling there is a very strong word. Dabak. It's actually the word that's used in Genesis 2:24 for a man cleaving to his wife in marriage. And so it will not cling, it will not cleave to me. He's not going to allow that. It'll try to cling to him if he gives it half a chance. We all know that. But he's not going to allow that to happen. He continues on and says, verse 4, "A perverse heart shall depart from me." He's so intense in his desire for goodness that those who have twisted, crooked minds, those who have stubborn, disobedient hearts, those who find no joy or encouragement in fellowship with good things, with godly things, he says he's not going to have fellowship with. He chooses to leave them. "A perverse heart shall depart from me." He's not going to remain friends with those type people. He's not going to continue to have them in his circle of associates. You know, the renunciation of evil men is almost as important as, and maybe as important, as accepting the association of righteous and good men. At the other side of that equation, he says, "I will not know wickedness." That word "know" there implies an awareness, an experience, but even more than that, it implies a personal love that's even illustrated oftentimes by the marriage relationship. It's the same word that we see oftentimes that a man knew his wife. He says, "I will not know wickedness." David has no intention of entering into any type of a close relationship with wickedness. He's going to keep wickedness at an arm's length at all times, out from his association. Then continues on into verse 5. That the vicious tongue is also something that's to be rejected. He says, whoever secretly slanders his neighbor, him I will destroy. The one who speaks against his neighbor or friend secret, that behind his back, says evil things. Slander is a kind of a three-dimensional problem, because it affects the person who uses those slanderous words. It affects the person who hears and listens to those slanderous words. And, of course, it affects the person that those slanderous words are spoken about. And so at least three people that are affected any time that slander is taking place. This type of slander and malicious gossip should not be engaged in. It should not be tolerated by God's servant. And we can see how that would be even multiplied when you're talking about a man in a position like David, who's going to be making life and death decisions about people in the courts and so forth. He doesn't want to be affected by those things. Continues on, he says, the one who has a haughty look and a proud heart, him I will not endure. Two figures, really, of a proud heart there. One is the haughty eyes, the haughty look that oftentimes represents pride, and then the enlarged heart, the proud heart. And so this one who is so prideful, he has a pride-filled heart. He's not going to remain in the king's presence. The king is not going to allow him to do that. The righteous is not going to endure his fellowship or be able to get along with this type of man who has these haughty eyes and a proud look. He says, him I will not endure. But then as we move into verse 6, we see, I will encourage the faithful. So he's got this list of ones that he's gonna keep out here at arm's length, at a minimum, from him as far as their influence. But now he's going to turn to the positive side and those that he intends to surround himself with. Those that he will encourage to be with him, because they're good people. They're going to be a good influence. He says, my eyes shall be on the faithful of the land, that they may dwell with me. He said earlier that he's not going to set his eyes on anything that's evil. But now he says that he will set his eyes on the faithful of the land. These are the good. These are the ones that will have a good outcome from surrounding himself with this type of people. Who will he encourage? Who will he imitate? Well, he says, he who walks in a perfect way, he shall serve me. He continues to use that word perfect. Again, it's used the same way each time, a blameless type of way. And so a person who possesses a balanced character, a loyalty, one who cannot legitimately be accused, people that are full-grown, mature in their righteousness. And so he invites these type honorable men to serve him. What does he mean by that? Again, remember who David is. He's the king. And so he's talking about people to come in to minister, to assist him. These are the type of people that he's going to surround himself. We're going through the process right now with a new president and trying to get all the cabinet members in place, the advisors and so forth, that he is going to surround himself with and draw wisdom from. That's the type of people he's talking about here that are going to serve him in that type of capacity. They're going to be those who influence and help him in being a righteous leader of a righteous nation. He knows that he'll be judged by and influenced through the cabinet that he chooses. Now, they probably didn't call it a cabinet back then, but anyway, we know what that means. And so these men who surround him are going to influence him. And so he wants to surround himself with the very best. Not just the very best military leaders, the very best treasury people, and the very best education people, but the very best godly, righteous people. That's what he's concerned about. He wants godly, righteous leaders. And then verses 7 and 8, he says, I will remove evil. Now again, he's kind of changed now from his personal focus, even back there in verse 6, to this more of the national, I'm the king, here's the way I'm going to lead, here's the way I'm going to judge type of thinking. And so the king's plans on dealing with the wicked, who, when he finds them guilty in the cases that are brought before him, one of the things that a king did was act as a judge. If you remember when Absalom came in and led the rebellion against him, that's part of the way he got the people on his side, was he went and sat at the gate and judged them as they were coming to David to be judged. But he ran interference before they got to David and gave them favorable judgments and won them over to his side. But again, we see a deceitful, treacherous, lying people are not going to be welcomed into his circle, into his personal circle or into his kingly circle, his circle of judgment. He says, he who works deceit shall not dwell within my house. Deceit, a person who's been slack in telling the truth. You know, when you're sitting in judgment, what do you oftentimes do? You bring in witnesses and you're going to listen to what those witnesses say. Are they worthy witnesses? Are they truthful witnesses? Are they ones that are full of deception? You know, a man who resorts to treachery and fraud to achieve his goals, that's the type of people that David is talking about, people who work deceit. He says, they will not dwell in my house. In other words, if David discovers that such a person is in his service, he's going to remove him. And he's going to replace him with someone who conducts himself with integrity, as they ought. The next verse, kind of the second line of the synonymous parallelism here, he who tells lies shall not continue in my presence. You know, saying the same thing in different words there, that one who speaks lies is not going to be tolerated in David's court. He's just simply not going to remain there. The king will pursue integrity, getting rid of that evil, embracing the good, and he'll take the necessary steps to purge the land of both private and public devotion to evil. He wants to live a godly life. He wants Israel to be a godly nation as he sits in judgment and really as God's representative in many ways over them. In ancient court cases, the king would normally sit in his judgment early in the day, in the morning time. And again, we see that with Absalom, 2 Samuel 15. It says, now Absalom would rise early and stand before the way of the gate. So it was that whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call on him and say, you know, and so he's going out early because that's the time that people were coming to court to have their cases heard by the king. And so again, he was there running interference. But David vowed that each morning, whenever these people are coming before him for judgment, that he's going to be prompt, he's going to be swift in his bringing of punishment on those who are guilty. He says, early I will destroy all the wicked of the land. These people that are guilty of wickedness, he's going to judge. He's going to just judge justly. And he's going to put those elements out of the land. You know, New Testament talks about a lot about leaven and getting that leaven out of the... That's kind of the idea here that David is doing. Early, The New American Standard says every morning. The American Standard Version says morning by morning. This is something that's taking place every morning, probably except the Sabbath, that these people are coming to be judged. And he's going to be there to give them a righteous judgment, a judgment that's done with integrity each day when they come. He continues on, that I may cut off all the evildoers from the city of the Lord. Again, he wants to purge not only his court, not only his life, but even the land of these evildoers. He wants to get them as far away from being able to influence him or his people as he can. And so he resolves to cut them off, to forcibly remove them from his land when they're found to be guilty of this wickedness. Again, being God's representative as the king over God's people, there's a requirement there upon the king, as David sees it, to be able to lead his people in that purity, to guide them to a righteous and holy life. So as we kind of make a little bit of application, again, around this whole idea of godliness, this particular psalm, again, doesn't leave the idea of godliness as just an abstract thing, as just ink on paper, but it puts it into the framework of an individual, of a noble king who's doing all that he can to get his heart right, to lead his people in the right way. And he wants to bring in those godly characteristics into his own life. You know, the driving force of David's life seems to be a man of integrity, a man that's godly, that's able to bring those attributes in. Peter wrote in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 4, exceeding great and precious promises. And he said that Peter assured us that we can be partakers of the divine nature through his exceedingly great and precious promises. We can become a part of that divine nature. It's something that can be done. And so we see, as we look at this psalm, godliness begins with a heart of integrity. That's what we see with David. A pure heart, a heart, again, that's called a man after God's own heart, but a heart of integrity. A heart that David saw integrity as the world's greatest need. And he saw that it needed to start with him. It needed to be within his court, his close associates, and go out in his judgments and so forth throughout the land that he had power over. The pursuit of godliness is the heart of God's religion. You know, if you can almost bring religion down to that one word, godliness. Becoming Christ-like, becoming God-like. Leviticus 19:2, God says, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." God wants us to be like Him. He wants us to take on His attributes, to be people of God, children of God, a seed of God, people that have those godly attributes. And so the new Christian is to bring on this likeness, the life of God, to bring in those characteristics. The pursuit of godliness becomes the natural ambition of a servant of God. If we have a heart like David, it's going to drive us to want to be godly, to want to be people of integrity that go out and take on those characteristics. Ephesians 5, verse 1, Paul says, "Therefore be imitators of God as dear children." We're to be imitators. We're to be like God. And then finally, the pursuit of godliness is, again, more than a theory. It's more than just some abstract thing that we talk about when we come and sit in the church building and hear sermons and sit in Bible class. But it's something that has to be lived. It's something that has to be fleshed out in our life, in the family, in the courtroom, in David's case, in the marketplace, wherever we are. This godliness, this integrity that David is talking about is something that we live. It's something that is who we are. And so David saw godliness. It's something that comes in and encapsulates the servant of God's heart, his position, his life. Is godliness our life? Is that our number one pursuit, is to be like God in our person, in what we surround ourselves with, and in all that we have influence over? Again, it just kind of boggles my mind sometimes as we look at David, and again, we know that David had his faults. He certainly wasn't a perfect man. But the heart. And these Psalms give us such an insight into the heart that David had. It's so beautiful. Such an example for us as we strive to get rid of the things that will influence to evil, embrace the things that will influence us for good, and live a life like God with those godly traits, a life like God would have us to live. Lesson's yours. If there's anyone here this evening who needs to respond to the Lord's invitation, that invitation is open. Whether you need to be baptized for the remission of your sins, you need the prayers of your brothers and sisters, or if we can assist you in any other way, if you'd let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.